Case number 11-7048 et al. Armenian Assembly of America, Inc. Appellant, Armenian Genocide Museum and Memorial, Inc. versus Gerard L. Gafshian, individually and as trustee and present former of the Armenian Genocide Museum and Memorial, Inc. and president and director of the Gafshian Family Foundation, Inc. et al. Mr. Consovoy for the appellants, Mr. Williams for the appellate.
Mr. Consovoy.
May it please the court, Will Consovoy on behalf of Alan Cross Appellees. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good luck on that one.
Your Honors, the district court's decision should be reversed, as a matter of law for several reasons. First and foremost, the district court incorrectly resolved appellant's good faith and fair dealing. In fact, the district court's resolution of that claim is found in one paragraph on one page, page 1236 of the joint appendix. And in that paragraph, all the district court held was that the claim was duplicative of the fiduciary duty claim. It is not duplicative. That is an incorrect interpretation of district law, and it is a reversible error in and of itself. The substance of that claim is what is known as the prevention doctrine. Under the prevention doctrine, contracting parties have a legal duty to clear the way for performance. They must not frustrate performance or substantially hinder it. That is exactly what occurred in this case. Through a series of actions beginning in 2006 and running through the course of 2010, appellees committed a series of acts that frustrated performance and prevented the museum from being completed by the deadline. The first act...
Does this argument appear in your blue brief?
It does, Your Honor, pages 33 to 36 of the brief. It's framed in terms of the relief sought, but the claim is clearly preserved. You'll see on those pages we discuss frustration, prevention, and all the relevant legal terms, so the substance is referred.
That is, though, I couldn't help but noticing that there were different lawyers on the reply brief and the opening brief. I certainly found that very well argued in the reply brief. I did have a little problem finding it in the opening brief.
It's pages 33 to 36.
That's only on the question of whether the deadline should be told.
Well, we think actually the correct remedy for good faith and fair dealing is to sever the reversion clause, period, full stop. And that's a remedy available under district law in cases like Aronoff and Drake and Weaver.
This 33, these complaints about the behavior of your opponent here are itemized and then says, having done so, equity compelled the district court to toll the deadline.
That is one remedy that was claimed. Of course, below, all remedies were preserved, and remedies don't need to be pled. Remedies would be a question in the court's discretion. These are all equitable remedies.
Right, but the standard is the liability question, and I think maybe they should have hired you earlier in the process. I'm just having trouble finding that same argument.
Sure, if you look at page 34, you'd see in the first full paragraph on that page, you'd see, starting in April 2007, Gafshian began a series of litigations whose effect, both singularly and cumulatively, was to derail the project and prevent its completion by December 31st, 2010.
But that was all in support of a tolling argument, as opposed to what you're arguing now is that that's grounds for reading the or for not enforcing the reversion clause, right?
Correct. I think those are sibling remedies. So what we're talking about is, was there a breach of the duty of prevention? If there was, then we're looking at a series of equitable remedies that in the court could exercise in its discretion which one to choose. The one highlighted in this particular aspect of the brief was tolling. And if that's the remedy the court ended up anchoring its decision to, and it was sufficient enough period, say the full 3 years during which the frustration occurred, I think that would be appropriate as well. But we actually think a cleaner way to resolve the case is the actually severing the clause together. But these are just remedies questions. They don't go to the substance of the claim. And if you look at count 3 of the streamlined complaint, if you look at the conclusions...
I want to stay with 33 and 36. Yes. So putting aside the remedial conclusion, what does it say about the point you're making now, which is one of if I understood you correctly, of duty and breach?
Sure. So if you look at page 33, the middle of the paragraph, prevention prevented that from occurring. As soon as he quit as president 3.5 years before the deadline, again, he instituted a series of lawsuits, filed the list pendants, wrote the articles in the Armenian Reporter. These are all the elements of the claim. These are all the predicate facts for the good faith and fair dealing claim. Now, the only question is, okay, maybe the words as we put them in our reply brief are somewhat different, but that's...
And better, I would say.
I appreciate that, but, you know, as cases proceed, sometimes, you know, you learn more about your case, and I think that's what occurred here. I hope, hopefully our brief brought some clarity.
Is there anything in the red brief that enlightened you, that all of a sudden you learned something about your own case?
Well, we obviously came in the reply brief, so, as lawyers. So right. We took a fundamental examination, and we went back to the district court opinion. And that's ultimately what we would ask this court to do, too. As a matter of law, again, the district court, I don't want to be too blunt, just got it wrong. Just, you know, there's a prevention doctrine in good faith and
fair. So is there a plain, you're making a plain error argument?
I don't think this is a plain error issue. I think the issue was clearly preserved. It was litigated to completion below. It was resolved, although wrongly, on the merits. It was preserved. The substance of the claim was preserved at pages 33 to 36. And it's been fully briefed before this court. I don't think there's a preservation.
The district court also said, apropos of this and of the point you're making out of this, that there was no harm.
And we disagree with that.
Let me just make sure we agree on that. If the district court's factual holding, factual finding is upheld, then what we've just been discussing is beside the point, correct?
I disagree.
Really?
But, because
no,
we don't...
No quit, harm but foul?
Well, we don't disagree with the facts as found. We disagree with the legal significance of the facts as found. And the district court made another error of law here, and this will be my refrain, with respect to how you measure harm,
Okay.
And so this, it's a separate, it's an aspect of good faith and fair dealing, but it's a separate one. As opposed to fiduciary duties where you're looking at classic causation, as Aronoff makes clear and Drake made clear, that's not the standard here. The standard is not, in fact, there's a quote from Drake, but for causation is not required. All that must occur is that the frustration materially contributes to non-performance. It's a much, much lower bar, a question the district court never examined. And once it is examined, we think the court can look at the factual record as it finds it and clearly find that, as a matter of law, there was frustration here. And I would just
the
like
legal
this,
standard, as you're quoting it, is what?
So
contribution?
Material contribution. Material. That's in the text of the Drake opinion just before footnote 20. That's important.
Not to be picky, but is that argued in the brief?
Yes.
In the blue brief?
We argued in front of frustrated performance. I think now we're into sub-elements of arguments, but I think the claim...
Is the argument that we're talking about now in your reply brief?
Yes. And again, just not to cover the ground again, but this is about claim perversion, preservation, all claims have been preserved here, so I don't think that's the question here.
Mr. Counselor, as long as we're on the question of what's preserved and what's not, are you still advancing the argument that the judge should have refused herself in this case? May we treat that as abandoned?
Noting that it wasn't in the reply brief and noting how well written the reply brief is, that may have been intentional.
We don't think the court needs to reach the issue at all.
Well, let's say you lose everything else. And therefore, we would have to reach the issue, wouldn't we?
We stand by the opening brief on that issue, as it's presented there. But again, we'd like to.
So that's it. So Wiley, Ryan, and so on, adopt that argument.
What, with respect to that argument, again, we do stand by it. With respect to how it was briefed on appeal, which is again different than how it was briefed in the district. Some of the issues that were raised in the district court. But again, we don't think the court ever needs to get there. We think this case is easily resolved almost exclusively on the good faith and fair dealing point.
Well, you're going to have to prevail on this material contribution point, aren't you?
We are.
Okay, so can we go back to that for a moment?
Absolutely.
What's the source of that phrase?
That comes from the District of Columbia's opinion in the Drake case, which we cite in our briefs, and it's in the text just prior to footnote 24.
When you say briefs, is that cited in the opening brief at all?
The Drake decision?
Yes.
I have to take a quick look. I don't recall off the top of my head.
You said Drake like a duck?
Drake, D-R-A-K.
Is it in the yellow brief?
It is. I'm not sure which brief. It's certainly cited in our...
Oh, it's a state case.
Yes.
It's a state case. So
yes.
It's, yeah. Interrated state of Drake.
Yes.
Page 9 of the
yellow. And it's in other cases as well. It's a core principle under the district's good faith and fair dealing law. And if I could, I'd like to walk the court through exactly how appellee's conduct materially contributed to the failure to perform here, because that really is the heart of the case. And they filed this lawsuit in Minnesota over a $500,000 promissory note which was already a stale claim. Then they seek rescission, but they knew they had no basis for rescission. Rescission, you have to, as Hornbook law, you're not going to get rescission of an entire museum deal over the failure to repay a promissory note that's been outstanding for longer than the statute of limitations. But they really didn't want that. This is what they wanted. This is the key to the case. It was the claim of rescission that allowed them to file the Liz pendants in D.C. That was the triggering event. And once they filed the Liz pendant, the game was over. That is the end of the case. Because a matter of district law, under the Heck decision, and under the D.C. Code provision cited in that decision, you cannot change the property once the Liz pendant is on file. So
when
everything
was it filed?
It was filed, I believe, in 2007 or 2008. That's it.
Right? I'm sorry, what was the date on that?
I will find that for your honor. But I believe it was 2000.
Is it before or after the second lawsuit?
It was, I believe, after, but I will get clarification.
So we've got the sequence of events here is that Capestrian and CFF sue on the promissory note. And in addition, seek rescission.
Rescission, that's right. Then they use the rescission claim as a predicate for filing the Liz pendants. And that Liz pendants is what's still at issue, is still there. Right? This is the litigation.
Now that's filed in February of 2008.
Excuse me, yes.
10 months later.
Right.
This case, you're saying, in order to be able to file the Liz pendants, but the Liz pendants doesn't show up until after the second lawsuit is filed, several months after that, 5 months after that.
That's right. I don't think the length of time changes the legal operative effect.
Well, you said they started the lawsuit so that they could file the Liz pendants, so that they could stop the construction.
Well, it's the only thing that allowed the Liz pendants to be filed. So it could not, as a legal matter, have been filed until rescission was sought in the Minnesota litigation. There would not have been a proper legal basis. Now, the fact that they waited, I can't tell you exactly why.
I'm not so sure that the Liz pendants isn't really related to the second case. Because it's in the second case that they seek an injunction against further development.
That's right, and that's a good point, Your Honor. And I don't really think I'm happy to take it either way because that action itself is also an act of frustration.
Okay, but that means we put the first lawsuit aside.
Well, I'm not conceding. I'm saying I don't think it ultimately. I don't think the court needs to decide. You know, I think as a legal matter.
Let's put it another way. Insofar as you're saying the filing of the list pendants reveals the motivation behind the first lawsuit. It puts that little point aside. Because if anything, it would have to be tied to the second lawsuit.
I think it may have been tied to either, and I understand your timing point.
But it's not just the timing, but it's in the second lawsuit when they seek to enjoin further development.
I don't want to.
Which is what the Liz pendants
sure.
was aimed to do.
But the rescission, if they had never filed the second lawsuit, the rescission claim alone would have given them a little legal predicate for the Liz pendants, too. They both did. But I would like to talk about the second lawsuit, because I think that is revealing as well, Your Honor. A year earlier, maybe even a year and a half earlier, Mr. Capestrian says he's washing his hands of the project and doesn't want any part of it. And then as soon as they start making progress, he comes in with an injunction.
What progress?
Progress toward the completion of the museum.
What progress did they make?
They were out there in the community. They were building plans. They were speaking to architects. They were raising money. As the district court found, they were starting to make a little bit of progress.
How much money was raised apart from the original $3.5 million, I think it was put in, other than by Mr. Capestrian, for the purchase of the bank building. That $3.5 million. How much was later raised?
Well, there was the money that,
other than Capestrian.
Other than the money used to purchase the properties, yeah. I believe there was a contribution by Mr. Hananian in the excess of $3 million, and they were at the doorstep for many more. The record shows there was a $10 million potential donation. There was a $1 million potential donation. And these were all
stopped. The district court made findings about why those were not imminent.
Actually, what the district court said, I went back and looked at this, is that it was not solely attributable. The failure to get the donations were not solely attributable to these issues. But again,
give me a page on that. I'm not sure that's all what you said.
Page J, 1229, district court made a finding of fact that litigation.
Can you put it into the Fed sub site for me?
Oh, sorry, I have the J set, but I will get you.
I will give us to that 12, what?
1229. That, and I'm paraphrasing, but the litigation conduct.
Well, wait a minute, I'm going to paraphrase anything, please. 1229.
As a former district court judge, I don't think you should be paraphrasing the district court's opinion that you're saying is error, you know.
I appreciate that. I was going to quote directly. I was going to start with paraphrasing and move into a direct quote.
All right, where are we on 1229?
There's a language in there where the quote is dampened and not solely attributable.
I'm looking for it.
The middle paragraph?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, litigation cannot be attributed solely to defendants.
Let's see. What I'm reading first is this. The evidence at trial did not establish that any donors changed their decisions to donate based on the defendant's conduct.
Right, and then it says, at most the evidence showed that donors chose to withhold the donation until the litigation was resolved and or the museum was opened. As the court has explained, however, they pursued that litigation in good faith. That's a problem in itself.
So hold on. The good faith problem.
No, but I mean, it's actually a confusion by the district court. The district court is now using its rejection of the merits claim as a basis for showing no injury. It's completely circular, right? As the court explained, defendants pursued the litigation in good faith. That doesn't explain why there's no injury. The district court can't have it both ways. But then the district court continues. Moreover, the lawsuit was only in the first of a series by both parties, so donors' concerns about the litigation cannot be attributed solely to defendants. But again, the issue here is not attributing solely to defendants. The issue is material contribution to the failure to perform. That's the substance of the legal claim.
Well, no, I think we're being a little not crediting the district court with what it's saying here. There's a Confestion, I got my name right?
I think that's it.
Confestion files the lawsuit based on repudiation of the $500,000 promissory note. And while he's at it, throws in not only payment of the $500,000, but rescission of the original grant.
The whole
he's saying, I want to, what'd you say, wash my hands of this, right? And they countersuit. Or bring claims of the same. So if all that had happened was Capestian makes this claim, then it would, and that caused someone to delay their donation, you would have at least a better argument. But there's a dispute between the two parties on a lot of fronts. And in fact, I believe the counterclaims are much more numerous.
There are disputes between the parties. I agree with that.
I mean, and so this dispute is what causes donors, potential donors, at most, he says, to delay their decisions about whether to fund this.
Right. And if this was an issue of but-for causation, I think we'd have a different argument. But we don't have to find but-for causation. If it's both of them, then they lose because they materially contributed to the failure. They're the ones who want to profit from the failure to perform. They're the ones who have to show that they did not.
Well, when they're seeking rescission, they're not seeking to profit. It's only later, when you get to the reversion, right?
Well, right. But again, the Liz Pendant is the big roadblock here.
That follows the second case.
Okay. Again, even if that's right, it doesn't change anything.
When would you have said they've been permitted to file the Liz Pendants without violating duty of loyalty?
I think it's really hard here, to be honest. I think they would have had to show a major showing because they would have to show something at least close to absolute necessity, right?
Well, if the statute says, if the agreement says, if the grant property is not developed prior to December 31st, 2010, do they have to wait? Assume they get something as a result of that. They have to wait until then? Even if waiting till then means somebody is going to develop it or sell it or something, which affects their interest.
Well, developing is in their interest, right?
But it has to be developed, not being developed. It has to be developed.
Right. So up until the end of December 2010, right, the parties have a joint interest under the contract. The joint interest is to make sure that the contract is performed upon. And the way the contract is performed upon is by the museum being finished by 2010. What they did was they didn't want that to happen. As the district court made a finding of fact, what they wanted was the properties back. They didn't want to wait until December 2010. So they took a series of actions to make sure that there was no performance by my client.
That finding doesn't relate to the filing of the first case.
Well, and this gets to another issue. This is These aren't separate claims where you have to look at one and show causation. It's a totality of the circumstances.
No, I understand that, but when you're saying what they really wanted, but all they're seeking in the first case, I realize it's a lot, what they're seeking is rescission of the grant money. There's no question of reversion. If that case had been resolved promptly,
they want a
in
rescission.
Their favor, there wouldn't have been reversion, never would have arisen.
Well, there would have been rescission of the overall contract, and that would have had, obviously, dramatic consequences, too. But they didn't leave it at that. I don't think we have to just look at it that way because they took further steps, several of them. We haven't even gotten to all, and I apologize, I'm over my time.
You're not over our time.
Okay.
On the list pendant, serves not only to, well, I mean, it doesn't legally require everything. As a practical matter, it brings everything to a halt.
As a legal matter, the property cannot be improved upon once the list pendant is filed. So they couldn't build the museum.
It cannot be improved upon, it seems to me, maybe I misremember this, meaning that any improvements that were made after that date would have been at the peril of the person making them.
That's not how I read the D.C. Code on this or the Heck opinion, Your Honor. I read it as a order by the D.C. Code to not improve the property. Now, the question is, if they did improve the property, notwithstanding the proviso in the D.C. Code, what could have happened to them? I don't know the answer to that. But my clients were not going to violate the D.C. Code. And so I think everything that happens after that is really just confirmation of what we already know, which is they couldn't meet the deadline because of the gratuitous acts by appellees. And that really is all that is necessary to cinch the claim. There was obvious prevention. It substantially hindered performance and materially contributed to the failure to build the museum.
There's a finding that as of March 28th, 2008, which is before the list pendants, the museum and memorial realized that it was facing a fundraising problem, perhaps undoubtedly due in part to the litigation, right? And would not be able to meet the completion.
I think the district court found that it was unlikely that they would meet it. But first of all, it's all...
Not just that it was unlikely, that they determined, the AGM&F determined.
I don't think that they...
They weren't going to make it.
I'd have to review that again. I don't think... That certainly my clients have never taken that position.
Well, in any event, by June, they halt everything because they don't have enough money.
And then they start picking up steam again, and they're raising. But again, this is all, doesn't matter, right? Because they could have raised $100 million between the day after the list pendants was filed and in time to build the museum. It would not have mattered. They had a legal barrier to improving upon the property. That was it. And again, the district court never really analyzed any of this because the district court found the claim entirely duplicative of the fiduciary duty issue, which it's not. The district court said it was the same legal standard for causation. It's not. And the district court found that we look at each separate act as an individual breach, not the totality of the circumstances, which was wrong a third time. And that's just on one claim. We actually have legal errors riddled throughout the decision. Also, with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty, as we know, the district court relied on Maryland law, the Clancy decision.
There no objection was made to that. Right?
Again, we're talking about claim preservation. Parties changed their arguments on appeal.
The counsel was from Maryland. Counsel cited Maryland law. The district court adopted that view. That seems to be the law of the case.
I respectfully disagree.
Not that Maryland law is the law of the case, but any objections to the court's adopting. Seems to be foregone.
I guess I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because we're not talking about claims, we're talking about arguments. And under Yee versus Escovedo, the Supreme Court has made clear you can change your arguments on the way up the legal chain. That's not a problem. The fact that the parties didn't catch an error in the district court doesn't mean they're forever barred from raising an appeal. The district court, the parties, Rule 12 motion.
But we certainly don't want to sandbag the district court by accepting what the parties either agreed upon, unless there's absolutely no legal foundation for it, and that happened once in a case, in which there's a statute that had been repealed in the court and both parties relied on it.
Your Honor, I completely understand the court's instinct on that, but at the same time, the court is interpreting district law, And if we have an opinion from this court that says that's right, people are going to cite that in district cases going forward that these claims are duplicative.
Well, not if we say that what Judge Ginsburg just said. The reason we're relying on Maryland law is because the parties below did and the district court was sandbagged.
I've not seen a decision where that would be appropriate because, again, under Yee versus Escobedo, the parties are allowed to change their arguments on appeal. There's no judicial estoppel here. We lost in the district court. Right? There's no waiver. Clearly didn't waive anything.
Well, there is such a thing as invited error.
There is something as invited error, but again, the district court, we didn't invite the error. The district court made a finding in the summary judgment ruling, which was never corrected going forward. But give me an example. If in a Rule 12 motion, if the parties relied on Rule 56, I don't think on appeal the court would say we're going to decide this case under a Rule 56 standard because the parties missed that it was a Rule 12 motion. This is that fundamental. We're talking about what is the basic source of law that is going to decide this claim. And the district court cited a Maryland contract case for a District of Columbia breach of duty action.
And only in a few moments will the other side have an opportunity, if they want to take it, to argue that this was not an error, right? It's not in the brief, right? And it's in the yellow brief, and they have no response. You could not file a response to that, and now you're making it here, and for the first time, orally, will it be their opportunity to object.
Well, if they thought there was
a
preservation problem, they certainly had license to file a motion with this court. But I take your Honor's point. We'd be happy to hear them out on this. And
don't do business that way. We're not a court of first instance. If there's a reason to send it back to a court of first instance, then then you're alive.
And if that's the remedy, of course, the court has latitude to choose whether to decide the issue itself, remand it for further consideration on the correct legal standard. We think this is a pretty easy question of law that the court doesn't need to occupy judicial resources to that extent to remand it. And as I said earlier, I think the fiduciary duty, the good faith and fair dealing claim is.
Can I ask about the indemnification issue?
Yes.
Say again what your problem with the district court's decision is on that?
There are multiple. So, one, obviously, if there was a breach of fiduciary duty, there's no indemnification.
On the reasonableness of the result.
Sure. Yeah. So, one, Your Honor hit the right word, reasonableness.
Yeah.
The magistrate judge found that the court did not have to review the award for reasonableness.
But the district court said, magistrate judge Case proposed methodology sufficiently accounts for any potentially excessive billing entries, ensuring the overall award is reasonable. So from the district court's point of view, the magic word is overall award is reasonable. Why isn't that enough?
Well, even if the district court made a finding that it was reasonable, mm-hmm. the district court was wrong on that.
But that is a difficult problem for you, given the case that you brought to our attention, which is the Bender case. Right? The Bender case, which does say there has to be a finding of reasonableness, which there is, says that subsequent cases make clear the trial judge decides what sort of proof, if any, is needed to determine what a reasonable fee would be in any individual case. Because a judge who has monitored the case from its inception is considered to be an expert on the value of legal services, she can fix the amount of the fee without hearing any evidence at all. Why? I mean, this doesn't give us, you have an argument about the Laffey matrix. It's clear from Bender that the Laffey matrix is not required in an indemnification case. Isn't that correct?
It is not required, but it is something the court can use.
But nothing that it must use. There's no indication here that our court says you don't need any evidence at all if you're the district court. You can't possibly need the Laffey matrix if you don't need any evidence at all.
It depends. Well, first of all, that's predicated on something of a fiction here, right? Because here, the district court gave it to the magistrate to decide. The magistrate had no experience with this case.
Well, she reviewed, though, the magistrate's decision.
For clear error only. And so I think it's slightly different than what the court is talking about in Bender. The message the court is sending in Bender is, if the district court, who sat on the entire trial, is reviewing de novo, in the first instance, the substance of the fee claim, then I understand, the court is going to give substantial deference. But here, that's not what occurred. But again, even if you take maximum deference, there are some problems here that the court has some duty to review, and the duty here, I think, should be exercised. And I'll just give one brief example. There was a dispute as to how much of the case was attributable to the single claim that could be indemnified. And we suggested as low as 9. They suggested as high as 67. The district court, well, the magistrate, settled on 50%. We disagree with that. We stated our position on reason. Then you get to the second question. Okay, how much of the time on that claim was well spent, and how much was not well spent? The magistrate says, I've already done that by giving it 50%. That's circular. That doesn't get to the question. It's confusing two entirely separate legal issues.
I think what he said was that the 50% decision adequately reflected.
But it didn't take in, we're talking about two sets of different sets of data. They don't add up together. The magistrate can't say, well, I think 50 is about right for one claim out of 11, which itself is problematic, and then turn around and say, oh, by the way, that also takes care of any inefficiencies. It was a highly disputed issue about how much percentage of the case. Settle on 50 itself was problematic. But then to simply wipe away all the other problems under that same reasoning, I think, is doubly problematic. Unless the court has further questions.
Oh, hear from the other side.
May it please the court, John Williams on behalf of the Profession Family Foundation and the other appellees. I'd just like to start by noting this issue of invited error with respect to the Clancy case. The Clancy case came into this case because it was initially cited by AGM&M in their summary judgment briefs, page 31 of their summary judgment briefs in the case numbered 08255. Let me start now by addressing this point that is raised with respect to the contractual claim of good faith and fair dealing. And the issue here, as I understand it, is that the district court failed to apply the prevention doctrine. As Your Honors, I think, have indicated, this issue of the prevention doctrine was never mentioned as such in the trial court. It was not raised in the opening brief, and I believe shouldn't be considered. But regardless, the court's findings below are more than sufficient to dispose of any allegation now that Mr. Confession's actions violated this prevention doctrine. The doctrine requires a showing that the enforcing party committed a breach of the contract and that the breach substantially contributed to a delay. But here the trial court held that there was no breach of anything and that nothing Mr. Confession did caused any harm to AGM&M. Judge's finding in the record at Joint Appendix 1228-30. The issue under Drake, same thing. It must occur when the plaintiff substantially hinders the performance. Here, Mr. Confession did nothing to hinder the performance. The briefs go on and on about bad conduct and harm and damage, but all of those allegations were specifically rejected in the judge's finding. So, Your Honors, even if the word prevention doctrine was not used in the opinion, the trial court made the necessary findings to reject any claim if it had been raised below. And let me pause for a moment and talk about this issue of Belize pendants. As the trial court held, both with respect to Belize pendants and the earlier filed memorandum of agreement, that didn't stop anything. All that did was to put the public on notice that there was a reversionary clause. We were involved, of course, in discovery below, and when we first heard this suggestion, this allegation that this memorandum of agreement and the leave pendants caused some sort of halt to the development, we went and took discovery on it. We took a lot of discovery on it, and we tried to find out what their allegations were. The only thing that they came up with was that this would prevent them from getting a loan. We asked who it was that they tried to get a loan from. It was the United Bank. We subpoenaed the documents and deposed the loan officer, and he said two things. Number one, they had never even applied for a loan. And number two, this would have no effect anyways because they would want to see the underlying documentation. All the Lee's pendants and the earlier memorandum of agreement did was to put the public on notice, and the court made those findings specifically. Plaintiffs have failed to prove that the MOA did anything other than record AGM&M's already existing obligations under the reversionary clause.
But if, as a matter of law, the lease pendants prevented any improvement, then wouldn't that have made applying for a loan to improve the property futile? Isn't that the theory?
I really don't know, Judge Wilkins, what their theory is. We tried to understand it below. Even if it had had some effect, they had never even gotten to that point. My understanding is the lease pendants, just as it says, it puts the public on notice of a lawsuit, which was entirely appropriate. Let me point out another thing with respect to this lawsuit. Mr. Confession filed the first lawsuit, but he did not file the lawsuit against AGM&M. He filed the lawsuit against the Assembly. The only reason AGM&M came into this in the first place was because they filed a motion saying we had to join them, or they joined them, as an indispensable party. Let me get to this point about Clancy and how the district court supposedly applied the wrong Maryland standard in addressing the fiduciary breach claims. The court did not apply Clancy other than in one instance, and that was with respect to the filing of the lawsuit. They only applied Clancy with respect to that, and that was pursuant to AGM&M, saying that that was the law on lawsuits. The court instead engaged in a very thorough analysis of District of Columbia law, and that's set forth in her opinion in Joint Appendix 1203 to 1207. The court cited a number of D.C. cases. First cited the Friends of Tilden Park case. Fiduciaries must act in good faith. That's where good faith comes right out of D.C. and manage the corporation in its best interest. It cited the Lucy Webb's Hayes case. Fiduciaries may not engage in self-interested transactions. Cited the Willens case. Fiduciaries' conduct must be substantially fair to the corporation, and it held under Willens that the business judgment rule that we were urging should be applied in the case could not apply because of this reversionary interest Mr. Confession had a personal stake. And so she applied for us the less deferential standard test of reasonableness. Same site as before. And that comes right out of the Willens case and also the D.C. Bolins case. She analyzed every one of AGM&M's claims, and there were dozens of them under this reasonable test. And as I said, the only time Clancy was even cited was for the proposition that a lawsuit can be brought by a fiduciary as long as it is not brought in bad faith. Now, the test, as I mentioned before, that comes out of the Willens case, which AGM&M asserts should be applied here, and it was, by the way. I want to talk about substantial fairness, because this is a concept in this case that sometimes gets ignored, and it's continually ignored by the appellants in this case.
Can you pause for 1 second? Is your argument that they didn't raise the contention that the duty of loyalty here bars actions that interfere with performance of the agreements, that they didn't raise that at all?
I'm sorry.
Your argument that in the district court, the other side did not raise this argument about prevention or interference? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all. All I am saying is that while the words were not used below, prevention, mm-hmm. she went through all of their allegations, and she found that there was no harm, that nothing we had done delayed the museum. She got into that significantly, factually. I mean, that was a huge issue.
The point being that, therefore, if the prevention doctrine applies, it's not the requirements are not met. Is that
right?
Yeah.
That's precisely my point. No fiduciary breach, number one. No harm to the corporation. But I wanted to get back with respect to the fiduciary breach claim, with respect to this issue of substantial fairness. Because the issue here is substantial fairness to whom? It's substantial fairness to the corporation. And the corporation here is AGM&M. And so when you look at to see whether these actions were substantially fair, you've got to look to the interests of the corporation and not to the litigants who claim to speak on behalf of the corporation. The district court recognized this and observed, really, that she understood that this was a dispute not between Mr. Confession and AGM&M. It was a dispute between Mr. Confession and the three dissident trustees, or they would call us dissident, but it was a trustee dispute. When that was brought to her attention, she said, I understand that, and the site is at Joint Appendix 1284. And the reason I raise it now is all of this, these allegations that we did things wrong and caused harm to the AGM&M is simply not true. The fact that it might have harmed one or two of them, they didn't like it because, by the way, then they wouldn't get all this property back. You've got to look at was it there. And number one, was this memorandum of agreement substantively fair to the corporation? Of course it was. It prevented them from secretly going out and selling the property to take it away from the museum. All of these things have to be analyzed through the prism of AGM&M and not the other defendants. Excuse me, not the other appellants.
Can I ask you about the agreement? On the question of about the agreement and about whether it, the grant agreement.
Yes.
Whether it provides that the entire property is to be.
Yes. It does.
Well, it says to the degree any portion of the grants has been funded, the assembly shall return to the grantor the grant funds or transfer to the grantor the grant property. Why isn't that at least ambiguous, the words to the degree? Such that you get a right to part of the property, the degree to which you've funded, but not all the property.
The words, let me go back, because they bring up this concept of extrinsic evidence.
Well, they only get to extrinsic evidence if the agreement is ambiguous. That's why I want to start with whether it's ambiguous.
Right.
It seems to me that is ambiguous, and you should tell me why not.
We disagree with you on it, because to the degree the funds were contributed, as the district court held, the funds were contributed 100%.
Ah, so you're saying that the entire portion of the grants had been funded, so
correct.
Therefore, but you would agree then that if only a portion of the grants had been funded, then there would be some proportional give back.
Absolutely. And that is why to the degree appears in the grant agreement. What happened was when Mr. Confession provided the funds in 2003 to purchase all these properties, when he entered into the grant agreement, one of the properties had not been funded. He had purchased it under an installment contract. This is the Sherman property at 1340 G Street, one of the adjacent properties that's now been torn down. When he bought it, it was under an installment contract, and he owed an additional $2.5 million on that. And so there was no question at that point that if those were not funded, no, he would not get that back. But to the degree that they were funded, yes, he would get them back. Let me raise one other point.
But the funds for the National Bank of Washington building Mr. Kafeshian did not effectively put forward all of the funds for that. He did because there was basically a cash flow issue, but then so he loaned some of the funds towards the NBW building, but that loan was paid back except for this portion of the promissory note. So why should the reversionary clause allow him to take the entire value of the entirety of the National Bank of Washington building?
Because that's what the agreement contemplated, Your Honor. That specifically was addressed in the negotiation process. But it happened initially, and I have a cite for this. This just
came out. You want to get into the negotiation process? I don't think so.
I mean, what?
Excuse me?
You want to get into the negotiation process?
Oh, I will, Your Honor. I know they raised it.
But yeah, I understand that, so you're passing ambiguity now.
Oh, no. I believe it is unambiguous.
Well, show me why.
Why isn't this answer that you just gave to Judge Wilkins that they haven't been, that it wasn't completely funded?
I didn't understand.
Judge Wilkins asked you a question which sounded in your answer as if you were agreeing that it wasn't completely funded because of the relations with the promissory notes.
I'm sorry. It was, as of 2003, other than the Sherman Building, it was completely funded. So when the reversion kicked in 2010, as the judge held, it was 100% funded. And another reason that it's not ambiguous, Your Honor, is because the judge looked at the grant agreement and said that she could not believe, I think she said it was inconceivable, that the parties would have assumed 7 years later that the property would have equal value. He had two choices, both of equal value. And further, that there was not any mechanism in this agreement to provide for some sort of procedure by which value would be determined.
Well, also, it seems to me that giving the grantor the choice necessarily implies that he'll choose whichever is more valuable.
Correct.
Therefore, they will be of different value.
Correct. And that's exactly what the judge will.
But looking at the language, let's look at the language of the grant agreement. It says, and I guess I'm at J463, this provision,
The grant agreement.
J463 is where I have the grant agreement. I mean, it may be in different places in the record. Okay, it says, to the degree any portion of the grants has been funded, and then et cetera, et cetera. How isn't grants defined in this agreement?
Yes, grants is defined as the first grant and the second grant.
Okay.
And the reason for that language was a portion of the second grant, the Sherman property, had not yet been funded. Let me also address, if you do care to get into this drafting history, it is very, very clear that everybody understood at all times that the money, that the property was going to revert back to Mr. Profession. Here's what happened. Up until right at the end, there was a question raised. The assembly actually had its own draft reversion.
Can I pause over this? She didn't look at the extrinsic evidence, is that right?
She did not.
So we only get to this if we decide it's ambiguous and send it back.
Correct.
Okay. For her to look at.
So I don't think you need to address this.
Okay. It
wouldn't help you even if you did. And besides, you're over time.
All right.
Any other questions?
Over time was invited error.
fair point. Fair
I
point.
Will note, I had a little more to go. She got.
Yeah, that's the problem with questions. Anybody else on the bench have questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Now, I know he was over time, but that was invited error. So we'll give you 2 minutes, Mr. Consovoy.
I'd like to pick up where Judge Garland and Judge Wilkins were with the contract interpretation, because we didn't get to that earlier. Both Appellee's reading of the contractual language, the grant agreement language, and the district courts give no meaning to the word to the degree. And under Appellee's, it doesn't even stand under his own reading, because not everything was even funded by this point anyway. So there's clearly at least ambiguity here.
Well, if If it is correct that the grants had been 100% funded, then there's meaning to this, isn't there?
I think it would be the wrong meaning, but...
Well, but it seems quite clear. To the degree any portions has been funded, so if it's 100%, you get back the property or the grant fund. That seems like an unambiguous reading. I thought that it's ambiguous as to what happens if only a portion had been funded, but they agree that if only a portion gets funded, you only get back a portion.
I think, well, one, the record is clear that there were at least $3 million that had not been funded, so I don't think the court ever...
Right, now, what is that? Explain that.
So the Sherman Building, counsel was referring to, there was a $3 million payment made well after this period, well after this provision was triggered. So even under that reading, it doesn't work.
By the time of the judge's decision, was it paid?
I believe it was during trial. But again, this has to do with at the time of the triggering event, not at the time of the trial. But I think it's actually pretty wrong.
The triggering event, December 31st.
Yes. Yes. Right? Yes. And payment was made after that. So that reading doesn't hold up. But I want to get to a more fundamental
question. Why is that the triggering? It just says if it is not developed prior to December 31st. It doesn't say look at what happens on December 31st.
Well, it's like he says, once confession says I want to exercise this right, at that point, the meaning he's given to the words have to exist at that time. Otherwise, it's not at any point in perpetuity in the future. It has to be at a particular point in time. But I want to just quickly say there's other reasons why there's tension here, not just the language. We think to the degree means...
Let me make sure I've got your point, because it may be. So when was the Sherman Building fully funded? So
at some point after December 31st, 2010, during the trial. I don't know the specific date.
Okay. I see. So... as of December 31st, you're saying it was not fully funded. By the time the judge reaches the final decision here, it had been fully funded.
That's right. So on page 17 of our brief, we do say that by the end of 2010, he had not funded approximately $3 million of the grants. So that is correct. So
here you are in trial. Is that when the funding occurs?
I believe so. But, Your Honor, we don't think to the degree goes to that point anyway. We think it goes to the degree you provided the funds, not to the degree any funds have been provided. And he provided less than half of the bank building, and in fact, reversion isn't even the right word for the bank building, because he never owned it in the first place.
It doesn't say funding of the building. It says funding of the grants, to the degree any portion of the grants has been funded.
Right. Right. We think that means to any portion of the grants has been funded by him, and they weren't. But you're on
the
question.
Because of the Sherman thing, you're saying.
For that and other reasons, but
there's
more. Well, he only for the bank building, for example, he paid less than half of the overall purchase price. Yet he's getting
a building. Grant, but that's all washed out between the grant definition and the consent.
I disagree on consent, Your Honor. I'm glad you brought it up because.
Well, before we get to that, what about the grant itself? At JA 641, I'm sorry, I'm looking at different JA pages. It says, amount of the grant shall grant the Assembly $4 million. Amount of the second grant on 642, the grantor shall grant the Assembly $12.85 million. That's the grant. So it's to the extent those grants have been funded.
And the second one had not been fully funded.
Okay, I get that, but that's different than whether the grant funding fully funded the building, though.
I understand, Your Honor. The bottom line question here, is there ambiguity in the agreement? Mm-hmm. The court has pointed to the to-the-degree phrase as creating ambiguity. We think that's right. But moreover, the reference and incorporation of the transfer agreement also creates tension and ambiguity in the district court's construction. Those who were parties to the grant agreement agreed to honor the transfer agreement. The terms of the transfer agreement require honoring all donors' intent. Ms. Mapposian was clear about her donative intent here. It was to be a donation of $3.5 million for the purchase of the bank building so that HM&M could build it. It should not be encumbered, and it certainly should not go to Mr. Confession so he could do with the property what he'd like, even though he never owned it in the first place. That fact alone creates enough tension to create ambiguity here. You can't ignore the transfer.
You've got
to
take it back half a step. You said the funding occurred during the trial.
The final leg of it, yes.
The $2.5 million.
I think it was three, yes.
Okay. The trial occurred in November of 2010. That's before the 12/31 drop dead date. Yeah?
Yeah, I don't have the, all
so
the data.
So therefore, if it was funded during the trial, it was funded before December 31st, 2010.
My understanding is it was funded after the triggering date. If I said, if my reference to the trial makes that unclear, I didn't mean to. My understanding is it was after the triggering date, and I believe that information is in the record.
Can you provide us with the citation?
We can get it by the end of the day.
It would be best if while we're all here, but if not.
If you have it now, that would be fine.
If we don't have it the second, we will get it to the court.
If there's days, then I'd like to hear back.
Yeah, same. All right, are there further questions, Mr. Constable?
At the time of the grant agreement, which was dated November 1st, 2003, was it contemplated or not that the grants from Mr. Kafizian would not be sufficient to pay for the entirety of the National Bank of Washington building?
Yes. So Ms. Mathibosian's $3.5 million was the lead gift. It was what started this endeavor. It has always been the foundation of the purchase of the bank building. She sent her letter indicating her intent well before any of this about what she wanted. I believe the letter was from 2000. There's a long process here, Judge Wilkins, about leading to the grant agreement, and in fact the drafting history shows that the bank building didn't come into it until the eve of the signing.
So my point, though, is that the foundation, perhaps, the Armenian Assembly of America, perhaps it was improvident, but they signed an agreement that said, that defined the first grant property as the National Bank of Washington. That's the way that term is defined in the agreement. And it said that if things don't happen by this December 31st, 2010 date, then you can take back either at your discretion your grant or the first grant property, a term that was defined in there as the entirety of the building, not defined as the portion of the building that you funded, right? And the agreement is written at a time when they knew that Mr. Kafizian's grant was not the entirety of the money that was used to buy that building, right?
I agree with some and disagree with some. Where I disagree, I think where it matters, is we just fundamentally disagree about what to the degree was intended to do here. The way we understand it is it was included, it was only introduced, that language. It said originally in the event. On the eve of signing, once the day they added the bank building to the deal, the grant agreement, which was after a long negotiation period, three nights before they're going to sign this, Mr. Waters sends an email, and this is the first time we have a first and second grant. This is the first time the concept appears between the parties. And at that juncture, the word in the event, which was the original language in that clause, was changed to the degree.
This is what we didn't let the other side comment on, so it really wouldn't be fair.
We think there's ambiguity. I think the discussion shows there's ambiguity, and they have no answer to the transfer agreement. All the district court said about the transfer agreement was that Ms. Mathibosian signed unanimous written consent. I have to confess, I don't know what that argument means. All that did was ratify prior acts by the board that had nothing to do with this issue. They took those acts as it found them, and one of those acts was a grant agreement that incorporated a transfer agreement, which this interpretation violates. So for that reason alone, we think it should be, at a minimum, remanded so that extrinsic evidence can be evaluated.
Okay. Hearing no more questions. And let me just ask Mr.
Do we have the citation?
Do we have a citation?
I do, Your Honor.
All right. And what's your position on this? When was the $3 million paid?
It was $2.5 million. It was paid over time. He had to pay.
When was it finally paid?
It was prior to the trial. Her decision, this is her May 9th decision, May 9th, 2011. I don't have the JA site. Maybe we can get it. It's page 25. It says Kafizian and CFF have fulfilled their obligations under the agreement.
Page 25 of which agreement?
Page 25 of the...
That's May 9th, 2011.
May 9th, 2011 opinion.
So, but we don't know when they were fulfilled?
She wrote such a careful and meticulous opinion.
Well,
I would believe that it is in her opinion.
All right. So,
but I'm happy.
Why don't both of each side, if you had found something by the end of the day, when was the $2.5 million or whatever, when was the final?
When was finally paid.
Finally paid, and a JA site, if you could give us one.
Okay.
No, that's the only. We don't normally have sur rebuttals. We gave
no,
you.
No, no, no. I'm just saying it's not in the joint appendix site.
Oh, any evidentiary record site will be fine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under submission.